Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is novelist, nonfiction writer, and essayist Nicholson Baker. He's the author of 11 acclaimed novels and 7 works of nonfiction that run from an impassioned defense of libraries and books on paper to newspapers to a year spent as a substitute teacher and a book on the beginnings of the Second World War. Along the way, he's won numerous awards, including the National Book Critics Circle Award and the Catherine Ann Porter Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His latest book is a decade-long search for an answer to a question he had on whether the U.S. actually used biological weapons during the Korean War. A question with an answer he can only surmise, as the confirmation remains an official secret document, despite a decade of Freedom of Information Act requests. His book details the substantial information that's already out in the public domain that suggests the answer, as well as an impassioned plea for governmental openness and transparency when it comes to the past. He asks, how can we learn from our past mistakes when that past is classified? The name of his book is Baseless, My Search for Secrets in the Ruins of the Freedom of Information Act. It's an interesting book written in an unusual format as a diary over the course of 2.5 months where he assembles all the information he knows about that question he's trying to answer. It's published by Penguin, and Nicholson Baker is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Nicholson Baker, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Very happy to be with you.
Your latest book, Baseless, was written in the course of 2.5 months after a lot of years of frustrated research, about 10 years of frustrated research, to answer a question that occurred during the Korean War. What was the question, and how did you come upon this question in order to ask it?
The question was, why were the Chinese saying, why were the North Koreans saying that the Americans were dropping insects on them and strange half-dead meadow mice and why were there these strange charges that became a sort of propaganda battle that Chinese were using on us? What, it's so outlandish. It's sort of surreal. So the question was, did the United States use actual disease weapons that they had in their arsenal that they were researching? We know that. But did they use them in a war zone or not? That was the basic question. And I used it as a way of getting at the whole thorny, entangled problem of secrecy and of transparency and of what we can know and what we can't know about things that happened a long time ago.
How did you come upon this question to begin with? You're going back to probably AP reporting of, mm-hmm. Baseless communist charges that probably came out contemporary with the times.
Well, baseless is the crucial word. Baseless, the Air Force had a program that began just after the Korean War went sour, when the Americans were in retreat, and it was called Operation Baseless, and the idea was to achieve a Air Force-wide capability in chemical and biological weapons at the earliest possible date. That was Operation Baseless. So I came across it, though, not knowing any of this and not being particularly interested in the Korean War or in biological weapons or anything, because I was working on a book about American newspapers and microfilm and was reading about the Cold War, and I came across this book that was just on a shelf in the new book section of the university library that I was doing some research and looked at this book that said that was, I think it was called United States and Biological Warfare, Secrets of the Early Cold War in Korea. It's by 2 Canadian historians. And I looked in the list of diseases that America demonstrably was working on, plague, anthrax, all this stuff, brucellosis, and there was this disease, coccidioidomycosis, that leapt out at me because it was a disease that my grandfather, who was a pathologist, had studied. It's a fungal disease. And I thought, this is just bizarre that the U.S. government is engaged in trying to perfect diseases and make them worse. Why would they do that? And that led me to actually get to know these two guys in Toronto. I ended up interviewing them. I inherited some of the papers that they had gotten. Years went by. I made my own Freedom of Information request, and here I am finally with a book, and it's a huge relief.
Now, that was an interesting story about how your grandfather shows up, and it shows up about halfway through the text that, you know, says, here is this disease, which was, I think, known as Valley Fever, right, that he had been researching. And of course, you have to ask the question, you know, was my grandfather involved in this effort in some way? What did you find out on that front?
Well, he was not involved in biological warfare research personally, but his close colleague with whom he authored a pathology textbook was, in fact, at Duke University, did take money from Fort Detrick and did work on germ warfare related research. The thing about it, the 1950s, that makes it such a strange time, that as in addition to, you know, shiny cars and great songs and wonderful stuff, there was this really paranoid side of the idea was to fight the communist plague, the communist infection, with real plagues and real infections. And so university departments of biology and of medical departments were funded all over the country, and people were working on finding ways to make diseases more contagious, to make the particles of diseases smaller so they would go deeper in the lungs, to make diseases of animals be infectious to humans, to, in a sense, radicalize obscure diseases and make them harder to diagnose. All this was paid for by the U.S. government in this kind of a remarkable explosion of research that happened all through the 1950s and into the 1960s, funded both by Democrats and Republicans, bipartisanly funded. Right. Kennedy tripled the germ warfare budget. So it's not that I'm saying things that are uniquely, you know, Democratic or anything. Yeah. And this all is still secret. I mean, a lot of it is still held back. The crucial question is still not answered.
Well, we do know that Fort Detrick was the germ warfare center. I mean, enough information has flown out. But I have to tell you, in the age of a pandemic, reading this book is sort of a frightening book to read. You know, and you understand that during World War II, there was this ethic and saying that, hey, there's a war on.
Right.
But that thinking never seemed to carry over after the war was over. It's ethical, humanitarian. Any concerns were brushed aside by the search to figure out the most effective ways to use these and develop these horrific weapons.
Right. Well, I think that what happened was once the atom bomb was dropped, it was just sort of like that was a precedent of using a scientifically arrived at weapon in a massive way against civilians. I think that after World War II, it's as if the generals who were in the Pentagon were all suffering from a kind of weird post-traumatic stress disorder. They'd all been damaged by how awful that war was. How many Americans died? How many civilians died in foreign countries? All those cities in Japan, not just the atomic weapons, but the firebombing. And it led to a kind of fear. Once there was a new enemy, it was no longer Germany and Japan, and now it's Russia and China. And what do they have? They have armies that are much bigger than the American armies. Even if you add to the American armies the armies of Western Europe, the communists will win on the ground. So if you want to prevail over a numerically superior enemy, the thinking was, you must go to the laboratory. And you must put on white coats and do things with nerve gases and with germs that people haven't done before. That's the only way to win what they thought was going to be an apocalyptic war. Atomic bombs were not going to win it. Only these awful new diseases were going to win it. And that which was a form really of insane kind of ingrown fear, carried on all through the 50s and into the 60s until finally you know, Richard Nixon said, no, we don't want to do germ weapons anymore. We'll sign the agreement. But by then, it had triggered a huge kind of arms race of biological and chemical weapons. So Russia had enormously ramped up its program. And so we're still dealing with the consequences of this misdirection of science, using really smart people who know a lot about how to do things in little glass tubes. We're paying them, we paid them for a long time to do the wrong thing in little glass tubes. And we're dealing with that right now. In this sickened world, we're dealing with the fact that there was a lot of very extreme, risky research that happened with viral diseases all the way through the Cold War. I am convinced that part of what we are dealing with right now is something that has a laboratorial ancestry.
My guest today is Nicholson Baker, author of novels and nonfiction. His latest book is titled Baseless, My Search for Secrets in the Ruins of the Freedom of Information Act. I have to ask this question. You know, this book does come out at a time when so many people are doubting the word of science. Your book gives us ample evidence that we should not always trust these symbols of authority. Can you maybe elaborate on this idea that this is perhaps one of the reasons people are mistrustful of science and the word of authority during a time of a pandemic?
Well, I think the way to trust science and to trust history and to avoid all kinds of disinformation is to have channels of access, have things be open and declassified. And unfortunately, American science was corrupted by way too much money spent on the wrong thing. And it's still hard to know when, you know, there are things happening in American laboratories that are too risky, that actual American scientists have written petitions saying, do not recreate this particular virus, do not do recombinant things with this infectious disease. So, and that those kinds of decisions about what to fund happen in secret, and that's just absolutely unacceptable. Just the way it is unacceptable for the Chinese to not be investigated, not to allow their laboratory to be investigated for possible troubles. Every laboratory, this book that I've just written, it's sort of a history of laboratory mishaps. And Americans have died researching very scary diseases that they cooked up in their own laboratories. Mm. So this is something that's absolutely relevant to what we're dealing with now as a planet. And we've got to open up. We've got to accept the fact that we need to know what science is doing as it's happening.
Well, you do make a compelling case in the book about the inherent nature of government secrecy. And it appears that even though you were asking sensitive questions, that the Freedom of Information Act, which is in the subtitle of your book, is just not working as it was designed and is really, I think, probably since 9/11, really been defanged.
It has been. It took a hit in the Reagan administration when the rules were changed and certain documents that should have been included in the Freedom of Information Act were excluded, were said that these are out of range. These will be, no one will be able to look at these. Ever since 9/11, there's been a kind of a downward. Even so, there are successes. It's just that we need to step it up, and there need to be consequences. If somebody holds back crucial information or actually destroys documents, say, for instance, when Helms destroyed the tapes that he made of conversations in his office, or destroyed the records of a huge and expensive CIA project that did a lot of damage.
This is Richard Helms.
Those people who actively suppress the past, there ought to be consequences to that, because they're doing something that is, in fact, damaging to our own sense of our own ability to learn from our own mistakes. So we've got to be able to know what happened. Otherwise, we're just kind of groping in a fog of non-remembering, which is what is in fact happening. We come to each new administration. New president comes in. You know, it might be an unbelievable kind of horror show, as the current one is, or somebody who does walk the walk, but we aren't able to bring to the evaluation of that presidency the kinds of mistakes and the evolution of policies from earlier administrations, because many of the crucial documents are still held back from every administration since Truman. That shouldn't be. Why would that be? This is a country that, you know, talks about openness. Let's actually open stuff up.
I found it really interesting, your experiences with the Freedom of Information Act, because the framework of it seems to work. It's just that producing documents are just endlessly clogged up by the system basically gumming itself up in a way to prevent the release of documents. I mean, what I found really interesting was you had correspondence with the people in charge of implementing the Freedom of Information Act. We're waiting on this. But it just, like, nothing ever happened. And it was, what was also fascinating to me was, you know, you were asking for documents about things that the secrets that aren't all that secret anymore, that, you know, there are things out there that sort of pretty much answer the question, but the document is sort of the evidence that says, right, yep, this is the answer to that question. And yet it's still gummed up.
It's so strange. So you'll have a box of, you know, with 1,000 pieces of paper in it, and it's talking about, you know, unbelievably lurid weapon systems, bombs stuffed with feathers that have, you know, diseases that infect wheat in order to, and there are policy papers about how we'll starve the Russians by killing off their wheat crop, and, you know, so it's all known. There's no secret about the actual weapon system, but what's missing is every so often there's a, you know, piece of yellow cardboard, stiff paper that says access restricted, and there'll be a document there that's been removed. Why was that document removed? Well, the only thing I can think of when I look at the dating of the document and the subject matter and the people who are sending it and receiving it, that's all I have to work on, is that they were discussing not the mechanics of that weapon system, but where it might potentially be useful. So the actual discussion of the use of a weapon somewhere against an enemy is the thing that's still being held back. Not the details of the system itself, because we know an unbelievable amount about balloon bombs and feather bombs and all kinds of spray tanks of germs and just unbelievably gruesome, horrible weapons against animals. But what we don't know is what people were talking about in the halls of government about where these things might potentially be used during a very fraught and very lethal war in Korea.
And getting back to your question of were biological weapons used in the Korean War, you mentioned feather bombs. You have ample evidence that the United States was working on feather bombs. That's where you have these bombs full of feathers that have been infected with a disease, and you have North Korean and Chinese reports at the time saying there's these, you know, the Americans are dropping bombs with feathers. And, you know, I mean, so you have these accounts, you have the American denials, but again, you can't get the corroboration that, you know, you can add 1 + 1 + 1, that equals 3, but yeah, you can't put the nail in the coffin because the government is holding back these documents.
Right, and maybe that will always be true. But that's part of the, I think, the usefulness, I hope, the usefulness of writing a book like this is to show that some things about the past will never be known in perfect detail, but the past is still endlessly rich and worthy and has things to teach us even if there are elements of a government that are actively holding stuff back, or even if the documents have been destroyed, there's still things that you can learn about. And sometimes the trail, the process of research is interesting. And I found that sometimes there were things, like there was the effort I mentioned where of mixing a fungal disease of wheat with feathers, which was something learned from the Japanese germ warriors, but was that technique required the American germ scientists to harvest this fungal disease of wheat in large quantities, that which had never before happened. And the thing that astounded me was that after they had these open-air wheat fields that were sort of fungal disease nurseries, but without roofs on them, the next year there was a gigantic stem wheat rust epidemic that covered, in the end, more than a dozen states, and a quarter of the American wheat crop was destroyed by this particular disease that had just been harvested in quantity by these germ scientists. So I think the implication is fairly clear that the first victims, and this is so often true, of a weapon system are the people who are actually working to develop it. The scientists make themselves sick, and then they have a weapon that they can use on an enemy. And it's over and over again that I saw that happening. Is the first victim, the first victims are the people who are actually involved in making something.
In your book, you've been asking for these government documents for close to a decade or more in some cases, and you eventually decided to write the book without the information you were seeking. But as a case in a Nicholson Baker book, you write this in a very unusual way. You write it in a diary form over the course of 2.5 months, every day an entry. And in it, it's a little tiny bit of memoir, but basically it is, what's happening on the farm the day you're writing. But you're basically just saying, I'm just putting down everything I know over the course of 2.5 months. And it's an unusual form for telling this story. Why choose that particular form to tell this story?
Well, partly it's because I didn't have the answers, and I thought that in order to talk about why I didn't have the answers, I needed to write it in a diary form. Perplexity has its own chronology. You know, when you don't know, you don't know in chronological order. So telling the story with that something happened in 1949 and then 50 and 51 wouldn't work. Also, it turns out because of the way these interventions happen in American history, that things that happened in Cuba in 1960 or 1959 are very applicable can teach us things about something that happened in Guatemala in 1954 or in Korea in 1952. So in some ways, what I found was the only way to pull all of this stuff out of myself was to give up and just say, I will write about what occupies my thought, what is gnawing at me in the order that it gnaws at me. You know, just take it for, get up in the morning, what is really puzzling you right now? And I just had to kind of give up on the idea of writing a traditional history and instead use myself as a kind of test tube experimental animal and say, here, you have been injected with all of this knowledge. And I have way too much. I'm always forgetting stuff. There's more in my head. I keep in my head. I mean, that's what happens when you do history too long. Is you have too much stuff in your head. So, what is it? Is at the forefront of attention at any given time? It's the thing I'm going to write about. So that's. It just became a kind of an exercise in the kind of controlled chaos that I assume a downhill racer has when they're going down, kind of turn and twist around all the flags in on a snowy hillside. It's just, how do you get to the bottom, given everything you is going to depend on, well, on what did you see on TV? What, you know, the Mueller report gets released at some point, and that leads me to write about certain redactions, absurd levels of redaction that I wouldn't have written about if it hadn't been released. So then I would write in that direction. Mm. It was just it was a way of getting a book finished that was possible to do also. You know, it's so hard to figure out what should come first, and maybe you have to give up on that and just go with what comes out of your fingertips when your fingers are at the keyboard.
The name of the book is Baseless, My Search for Secrets in the Ruins of the Freedom of Information Act. But my guest is Nick Baker. We only have a minute or so left, and I want to ask about a phrase you found while reading about an event unrelated to what you were researching. It was about the Berlin Tunnel. It was a phrase that a CIA official came up with, and it was the flat, indignant denial.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that sort of sent chills down my spine, because how many times have we heard a denial by the U.S. government that was basically, you could describe it in those terms?
The idea that ahead of time they would be talking about what happens if the secret of this Berlin Tunnel comes out. The reaction should be flat, indignant denial. Yes, that was that. When I saw that, I thought, that explains so much. It's not just a denial, because we know about this phrase, plausible deniability. It's that you deny with a certain huffy emotion that the charge could even be made. And we've seen that. We know that to be true. And that's why the title of the book is Baseless, is because Baseless is the name of this government program that the Air Force cooked up to build biological weapons. It was called Operation Baseless, but it's also a name that has indignant denial built into it. These charges are baseless, and we categorically reject them. You know, it's the kind of thing that State Department officials have been saying for decades about all sorts of things. And maybe some of those charges are baseless, but some of them are very not baseless. And when 10 years later, you think, oh my God, they were all lying. And they were lying in this huffy way. And it's just surreal. It's surreal that would be true, and not just true, but required of the participants in advance was the idea that it would be an indignant denial, that the emotion was built into the denial.
Nick Baker, it's a pleasure to speak with you again. The name of the book, Baseless. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for your excellent questions. I appreciate it.
Novelist and nonfiction author Nicholson Baker speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Baseless, My Search for Secrets in the Ruins of the Freedom of Information Act. It's published by Penguin. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.